Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm one of your co-hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in.
And I'm Ann Kinzel, your other co-host. Welcome.
Today is the anniversary of another historical moment when military action was used against demonstrators. It's the anniversary of the infamous Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, when the Chinese military opened fire against demonstrators for democracy, killing hundreds and some people think up to 10,000 people. A moment to remember and to contemplate the reality of using military against one's own people. But turning back to our local community, our area is full of talent and skill, and the Iowa State News Service recently wrote an article with the headline stating, Iowa State faculty staff work to help others as pandemic continues into summer. They wrote that while bringing an end to regular school year activities, the current crisis with the virus has also created a moment to think outside of academic silos and to find ways to help a variety of communities. So we wanted to hear from the professionals in three different disciplines at Iowa State that were featured by the Iowa State News Service to hear how they altered their professions to, as they say, pivot during the COVID pandemic.
After that, we'll learn more about how the city of Ames has adapted to the COVID-19 crisis when building official Sarah Van Meteren talks about how her division works with neighborhoods, rental properties to continue working during the pandemic.
Jeremy Thurlby is the ISU College of Design Model Shop Manager. Welcome to Local Talk, Jeremy.
Thank you.
What exactly is the College of Design Model Shop?
The College of Design Model Shop is a multi-use facility. It comprises of a wood shop. It has a CNC router. Pretty much it's open to all the students in the College of Design. They come down, they work on their projects. I'm there for the students to assist them in technical issues and building their projects. They want to create site models or use some of the more advanced technology. That's where I meet with them one-on-one and help assist in that.
So are you located at the university campus itself?
We're actually at the university campus in the College of Design building.
Across the street from the ISU cemetery and the golf course, is that correct?
Correct, and across the other way from the armory.
Got it. So you've been making, quote, ear savers to alleviate discomfort for hospital staff who wear masks. Could you explain?
Sure. The ear saver is kind of a simple device. Hospital staff, when they're wearing their face mask all day, the face mask actually pulls on the back of the ear, and throughout the day, it has chafing and discomfort from that pressure and the actual strap rubbing over the ear. So it was suggested by my supervisor to see if we could make these. So I sat down and whipped out a couple designs and then started testing different variations. I ended up doing about 10 different prototypes initially, testing them on a coworker. And then we sent those out to area hospitals to actually test them, get the nurses and the doctors feedback, suggestions in the design. One of the issues we ran into is my coworker and I both don't have hair. So the original designs were a little bit small compared to the professionals with hair or caps. So we had to make them a little larger to accommodate for that. And then since then we've produced, I think we're at a couple hundred right now between the Boone County Hospital and Mary Greenlee here in town. We also delivered some to a clinic in Des Moines as well. So we've gotten a variety of them out there in different places.
So this is kind of a nuanced project. How did you even become aware that this was a problem, that the mask was irritating people?
That actually would come from my supervisor, Mike Miller. He had connections in the various hospitals. When you do talk to the various people, it is an issue. And when you're thinking of a standard nurse works a 12-hour shift wearing a mask that entire time, it does make sense.
So, Jeremy, is your design available for others to use across the country?
I really haven't opened it up to that. There is tons of designs out there on Thingiverse that are open for Creative Commons, which you can download in either 3D print or laser cut. Many of the different designs out there are 3D printed. We went with laser cutting to make it a little bit faster and easier to produce.
Is there anything else in your design that's different than others besides the fact of how you produce it?
We heat bend ours, so that's one of the differences. So ours are bent in two directions. A lot of the ones that are available online are bent one dimension, where ours are bent two dimensions to kind of help wrap around the head. And by creating the kind of the upward sweep, it alleviates some of the downward pull on the mask. We tested two or three different materials before we found one that was not only flexible, but wasn't fragile. Some of the initial materials we made had a tendency to break. So then we started doing some research and reached out to some plastic suppliers to kind of get some suggestions from them to see what the ideal material would be for this.
Did you get feedback about the mask from Mary Greeley? And from you, you also gave it to the hospital in Boone, right?
Correct. I mean, both of those gave us feedback on the initial designs, and then the second designs we sent to them for testing, and they came up, saying that the design worked perfect after we picked a later material and made some slight alterations, and they're quite happy with the ones that they have now currently is the last we've heard. So,
Sounds like quite an involved process that you went through to do this. What's your educational background? How did you learn to do all this?
I'm a non-traditional person. I didn't go to school right out of high school. I went into the trades. I was a welder, millwright, shipyard welder. And then back in 2008, I went back to school and fell into the art world. So my formal education is in fine art. I have a MFA in sculpture. While in grad school, I learned digital fabrication, which encompasses CNC router work, laser cutting, 3D modeling, which are all the resources I use here in my job every day. So that was really stuff in my personal work, my education, and then, as part of the position here, I'm responsible for the laser cutters and the outlet centers on the CNC equipment. So
Jeremy, can I make a request?
Sure.
I really want a face shield. Are you guys going to start making face shields?
The CCL has actually been making face shields here.
The who? Who has?
CCL.
What's CCL?
So it is the Construction and Computational Lab, I believe is the acronym, which is part of the College of Design, but they've been working with Alliant Energy to produce face shields for the area hospitals. They've produced just over 2,000, if I remember correctly. So they've been 3D printing the face shield holders and then actually laser cutting out the mask or the shield itself, I believe. And then Alliant's been dealing with the distribution for those.
So they've been providing those to the hospitals as well?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, save one for me.
All right.
The College of Design is still available for students to use, right, even though there's not many students around?
It has not been. It has been closed since before spring break. We helped out a few of the grad students that were finishing up for graduating. Outside of that, the building's been closed pretty much since spring break. We're just at the point now of starting to plan some of the staff and the faculty coming back to the building. Probably the middle of the month here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Did you find it a satisfying project to do this? And what did it end up meaning to you?
It was definitely satisfying. I mean, it was kind of something to cure a problem that I didn't know existed. In many ways, I thought it was something simple, but getting a lot of feedback and a lot of positivity about it, I was just glad that I could do something to use kind of my skill sets to help out of this. And especially I'm not necessarily trained in the medical field. So it was just, something I could help during the coronavirus. I mean, that was kind of the most important part to me to be able to give something back to this.
Yeah. And it's nice to be able to do something,
Exactly.
And I guess it really raised your awareness of, one aspect of the medical profession in terms of what, what people have to deal with when they're in that field.
Very true.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us. It's nice to really kind of drill down and focus on individual acts and what the virus does to different professional areas. So thank you so much for joining us. You're welcome to stay and make comments as you wish. We're going to speak with Kason Murphy, who is the assistant professor of theater at Iowa State University. Kason, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
The ISU News Service introduced you by saying the show must go online.
Yes.
And it says that students were in the midst of rehearsing for the musical comedy 9 to 5 when the pandemic hit. The Iowa State Music and Department had to cancel its final two shows of the seasons. Knowing what goes into preparing a performance, that's a devastating decision to make for a theater.
Yeah, it is. And we were 2 weeks away from production on 9 to 5. So we were really in that last little bit there. So it was pretty hard for the students to not be able to perform.
That must have been a terrible moment when that finally became clear. I hear that the performers went ahead and did their final dress rehearsal anyway, just to give closure. Is that true?
Yeah. About when it became sort of clear that we probably were not going to be performing the show at its original time slot, one of the cast members was like, could I maybe invite my mom and dad to come and see it just so they can see the hard work? And then when I was like, yeah, of course, then everybody else was like, well, I've got maybe three or four people that want to come and see it. And we ultimately had an audience of about 70 people that evening, which was not insignificant. And they really just brought all of their skills and talents to that particular dress rehearsal. They came up with costumes. They found some props in our props closet that they were able to like utilize and kind of make it feel like a show as much as it could be.
That's fantastic. It must have been just really an incredible atmosphere in the room.
Really electric. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And we had one performer who couldn't be there that night. And so I had to step into that role that is a very minor role at the very end. And it was just really fun and really transformative to be up there with them and feel all of that energy. And, it was just something that I will remember for a very long time.
I'm sure. So these are the alternate memories that we take with us, right?
Yeah.
to replace the disappointment. And, I've from my experience with the ISU Theater Company, there's a tremendous amount of positive energy always among the young people that are working on these plays. So talk about Zoom plays.
Yeah. So this is a new thing that is happening. As, prior to March, most people didn't know what Zoom was, but it's been, as you well know, it's been a way for people to be able to get together and continue to do the things that they do. So Zoom plays are sort of this new genre that are out there. Some people have been doing readings of plays that have already been written just on Zoom, kind of creating that sense of a communal performance. But we're starting to see a lot of playwrights creating works that take into account this filter of a computer screen or this temporal and social distance. So the play that I was in was called Pyramus and Thisbe, which was sort of a an adaptation of William Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, where all of us were in our individual homes and we rehearsed. We found spaces that sort of were neutral or that we could kind of design to make look like where we were supposed to be or be together. I was part of a group, the Rude Mechanicals, who are putting on a play in and of themselves. And the six of us found like neutral walls and or white doors in our houses that we all just happened to have. And so that kind of made it feel like we were in the same space, even though some of them were in Tennessee, some of them were in North Carolina, some of them were in Chicago, and then myself here in Iowa. And some of the characters went outside in their yards to make it feel like they were out in nature. So there was a lot of really innovative and fun ways that they were using. We figured out how to use space and time to sort of make it feel like we were all together, even though we were clearly not.
So do these plays get recorded, and are they available for people to watch other than Zoom Live?
Some of them, yeah. It all depends on copyright, but something with like Shakespeare, that's an adaptation that was created by the guy who directed it, that is freely available. And they have since done another production. They're calling it Self-Isolated Shakespeare, which is very clever. And certainly there are other groups out there that are finding ways to record those for posterity or for archival purposes. And then, depending on the rights, they're able to keep them up online so that they kind of exist outside of that, that one time only.
If our listeners wanted to see this, zooming version of Shakespeare, how would they find that?
Great. So yeah, you can go, onto YouTube or on Facebook. If you look for Scenic City Shakespeare, which is, they're located in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They should have both of their productions up online there, either on either of those platforms.
So it's a Scenic City Shakespeare.
Yeah, Scenic City Shakespeare. And they're a group that had just gotten a nonprofit status last year, and this was going to, they were going to do Pyramus and Thisbe as a live production. And then the pandemic happened. And so they rapidly rechanged, their entire model of creating, and their artistic director, Ryan Laskowski, just happens to be really, talented at a lot of like technological, he's proficient in a lot of different technological means. And so he was able to run all of our individual feeds through a streaming platform called OBS, which is usually used by gamers online to do sort of like a split screen thing. And so he managed to sort of like create these really beautiful digital backgrounds and run all of that through one central system that he was able to control. There was music, there was pre-recorded stuff alongside the live stuff, and a lot of really innovative stuff in a 2 week turnaround during that 2 week of rehearsal that we had.
Wow. This is really fascinating in so many ways.
It's really
the director really kind of, I can't really say he becomes a filmmaker, but it's something kind of between theater, painting, and film, because he's really working with a grid, right?
Certainly, yeah. And figuring out how to work that grid. And I got to watch their second piece, which was a rewrite of Twelfth Night. And what they were able to do with that piece, just even with a little bit more time, was really incredible. Like they had, it's not just the little squares of people's faces in Zoom windows, but they had things that were overlaid those so that some of the windows were overlaid and with digital greenery, or, and it looked like somebody was in a window. And it was really, I feel like I'm learning so much. Like it's one of those moments where like a professor becomes a student again, because it's a whole different way of creating a live experience that, you know, that 6 months ago did not really exist in any great way.
And it's a whole different experience for the actor too. I mean, you're not on a stage.
Oh yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. You have to like turn off your like self-critic there, because you're looking at yourself in the Zoom window along with all of these other people. And you have to be like, I can't pay attention to what I'm doing right now. I have to put my focus on other people. But the company was so great, and they were, the actors were all so engaging that it made that process a little bit easier to turn that off. And then you're running around in your house and changing costumes and, you know, running to a different location and then turning on your camera at the right moment and hoping that everything goes well. It's just,
do you think this is going to be a permanent art form now?
I think it will exist alongside traditional theater. I mean, certainly everybody wants traditional theater back, but it's going to be a long road, as if there's any indication, as the reports are coming out from how Broadway is faring and how other small theaters are faring and trying to be able to make these make it safe for their performers and for their audiences. So I think we will continue to see this be around for a while, and I think because people are becoming so proficient at it so quickly, that these skills are going to enhance the craft, whether we are in this digital world or whether we find ways to pull those forward into live performance. I think we'll see a lot more multimedia stuff going from this.
Kason, how does this work as an actor? We hear a lot about sports being played in empty arenas and athletes not having the feedback of the live audience. How does this affect you when you are acting via technology?
It's certainly an isolating experience. It's something much more akin to like film, where you are not getting that live feedback. And that's unfortunate, because theater is, that in its definition, one of the three things that you need is a shared space between the audience and the performer. So you just have to, rely on those your own individual feedback a little bit more, and you rehearsals were definitely a little bit more different, because a lot of it was about, oh, this camera angle works well, or ooh, there's something in the background there that is right, strange, or can you turn your microphone on and off here? So it required a different processing speed, and you're thinking about the filter, which is this computer screen and the Zoom call alongside the lines that you're saying and alongside the character that you're trying to build. So it's been a totally different experience, but I look forward to kind of bringing that experience to my students in the classroom.
So even when you're acting in a film, you're still operating in a three-dimensional space.
Correct.
But here you're literally in a two-dimensional space while you're performing.
Correct. And it's so easy because I think it's really easy for us to sort of get distracted by things on the screen or to not give it as much attention as we would somebody standing in front of us saying lines. So that it definitely tested my ability to just like focus in for 90 minutes to create a piece of art that was happening on something that I'm writing on or that I'm watching a movie on or just kind of surfing around on the internet on. It sort of redefined my relationship with my computer and my phone quite a bit there.
Can you see yourself in a class on this at some point?
Well, I'm going to be teaching acting for the camera in the spring of this, of next year. So I think this will definitely be a component of that now.
Okay. Well, that is, it's a whole new world. It's really amazing.
It really is.
Who knew? Thank you so much. And, let us know when your first performance happens with the Iowa State students on.
I appreciate it. I would be glad to.
Yeah. The third person that was in the, featured by the Iowa State News Service was Sarah Nelson, who is a STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics specialist. For the ISU Extension and Outreach School of Education. And she works with 4-H programming. And according to the ISU News Service, 4-H serves all of Iowa's 99 counties. And this was an amazing statistic. One out of four Iowa youth participate in at least one 4-H program. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's a fabulous group to work with.
So, Sarah, how has the pandemic shifted your priorities in your work with 4-H?
Yeah, so we had to do some pretty quick shifting in how we deliver a lot of our things that we do with youth. And it's been amazing, though, because we have such a great team that really pulled together to offer things virtually or things that youth could pick up and take home, kind of no contact pickup. Take home and do, but then also challenges that we did statewide, like the face mask challenge. And so far we're up to 28,000 face masks that people have sewn and donated. And so just a lot of great opportunity, new people that we've gotten to work with too. What I love is that we have had to think differently and be innovative and work maybe with people that we didn't work with in the past. And out of that grew some really great ideas.
So describe some of those ideas.
Yeah. So one of them is we work on a project called Gardening to Give, and it's a collaboration between a lot of my colleagues. And so far we have about 1,000 households signed up across the state of Iowa. And so what it is each week is delivered a new lesson about gardening. And then the youth and maybe the youth and their families work through these challenges. And we hope at the end that there would be food for loved ones, but then also maybe a chance to give food to a food bank or another group that might need food. And so it's just been a really interesting chance to think about what we do in a new way and deliver it in a new way. So that's one called the Gardening to Give, and you could still sign up if you might want to participate in that.
So when you say you can sign up, anybody can sign up?
Yeah, anyone in the state of Iowa can sign up for it. But, well, in all honesty, we have people from Minnesota and other states signed up, too, because it's all delivered virtually, so it's not really a problem. We did have a point, though, where if you signed up by a certain time, you got some gardening tools with, of course, the 4-H clover on them. But I don't know if that's still going on, but it's still open if you want to sign up. If you and maybe your family members want to participate, you're more than welcome to sign up on our website. Just kind of go to Iowa 4-H, and you should be able to find it, no problem.
Sarah, you said you were working with people that you had traditionally not worked with. Who are these new people that you've brought into 4-H?
So one group that we've really enjoyed working with also is the NASA Iowa Space Grant Consortium. We have worked with them in the past, but this time we started up an online STEAM Academy science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And so what we did is we took some of NASA's newer lessons and we shared them out, you know, in our network, developed some handouts, those types of things, videos that go along with them. And so that in particular has been a really fun partnership. We've also then worked with engineers from NASA to do NASA story times for Iowa 4-H and just a bunch of different things along those lines. What's great about that program was that it wasn't just Iowa. It was actually other states too. I'd get emails from people saying, here's my daughter doing, you know, this activity, and there she would be making the rocket that was going to be launched and just some things like that.
Wow. It's really, you know, the traditional image of 4-H youth is the image of, you know, a 12-year-old child bringing their steer to the county fair, right? This is a whole new dimension.
Yeah, you know, they have a, you know, a great history, but definitely we've expanded into lots of new areas from the arts to STEM, you know, to civic engagement and all of that. And so it's been, you know, again, an opportunity for all of us to look at things a little bit differently than we have in the past and really think about how we're delivering the youth experiences that we are providing. And then also think about accessibility, though, too. You know, what is it that we really need to do to make sure everybody can participate in these activities?
When you say everybody can participate, like Ursula, my vision is of rural kids. Mm-hmm. How does 4-H interact with non-rural, suburban, urban children?
Yeah, we have, so because we have an office in every county, that really, you know, helps in that. So, like, I think about Polk County, I just saw the things that they put up for their virtual camps. And then we also have a partnership that has started with the Science Center of Iowa. And so we try to partner with community members or community groups, you know, also within, you know, urban settings in addition to really help deliver different experiences to youth. So we usually try to look for community partners wherever we are and work with them and help deliver it. But, you know, virtually it poses some challenge when you're talking about education. And so what we've also then done is create kits that you can pick up. And so what you need to do then is contact your county office, sign up for whatever program you might want to do. And then they call them Clover crates and things. And you can then go and pick up the crate, take it home, and all the materials are there for you to do. So we hope no matter what the setting, urban or rural, you would be able to take part.
I have to ask, because I'm totally not the kid who took a steer to the fair, what are the four H's?
You know, that's a good question. And the four H's are head, heart, hands, and health. Those are the four H's.
So what is summer slide?
Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes what happens is there's some months over the summer, you know, where you're maybe not going to school. And so it has sometimes been shown that you can, maybe by not practicing certain skills, whether they're literacy, math, or STEM, can maybe slightly go back or at least not advance your skills. And so that's what they were talking about in the article, the summer slide. And so we just encourage all youth this summer to keep reading. You know, maybe take part in some of these 4-H camps or other camps that you might have access to. But again, you know, reading and asking and answering questions. I'd love if you took part in some of our STEM activities, of course. But that might help with some of the summer slide not happening.
So I've heard about virtual plays, but what's a virtual camp?
Yeah, you know, that is interesting. That's a good question. So what we've done actually is we've looked at research on kind of distance or virtual learning and how to set that up. And so what we try to do is create an experience where you have all the materials you need at home, but then you might get together with an educator online and he or she would help guide you kind of through the activity or be there as a resource for you. And so you kind of go in and out of the virtual world with your educator. And what I love about that, though, is that that makes then the interactions online, you know, be interact. Okay, that wasn't the way to say it, but it makes your time online help you build community and make connections versus just having you sit and watch somebody do something. You do the activity probably ahead of time, and then you get together online and talk about it and break it down, maybe learn some content, ask questions, that kind of thing.
What age kids are going to virtual camp?
Yeah. So, you know, we looked actually into this quite extensively because we all know a kindergartner really shouldn't be sitting, you know, online super long. Not only is it tough to do, but it's just not appropriate either. So we do have experiences that are K through 12, but the amount of time you're going to be online with an educator, you know, either is reduced or expanded based on research. So
the one of the reasons why young people join camps or projects like this is because they want to be with other young people. Mm-hmm. And this is, you must be communicating with the young people involved and getting some sense of what is happening to them. Are they actually experiencing, we've had, this would have been a long summer slide because they haven't been in school for a long, long mm-hmm. time, and they are somewhat isolated. Are you getting a sense from them of what this is shaking down to for them, for many of them?
Yeah, and you know, I have two kids here, you know, at home too, kind of going through through similar things. It can be, there are some challenges, of course, to online learning. And so we'll keep working to address those. But I do think that sense of isolation is something that we've actually really tried to focus on also. You know, how can we help them build and connect with other people when we were, you know, all at home or in other places? And so, yeah, you know, connecting is going to be really important, building community, making sure people don't feel isolated, you know, that mentally and physically they're in a good place also. But the learning is different, isn't it, when we're online versus in person? And so really looking at what's effective and what's not effective is going to be important for all of us.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Sarah Nelson, with the STEM program at the ISU Extension and 4-H. And thank you, Kason Murphy, with the ISU Theater Department, and Jeremy Thurlby, with the ISU Design Department. It's just really beautiful to hear how you are, as they say, pivoting, adjusting to what we're all dealing with. And it's just very inspiring to hear what you're doing. Thank you so much.
Human creativity just keeps on going.
Yep.
Cause we all got pretty used to this, closing our eyes and disbelief, but that won't make it any better. We sit in silence day by day, hoping it will just go away, pass until it doesn't matter. But I want us to change. I want us to say their names. Think of it as a mistake or else I can't breathe. I want you to feel their pain, 'cause after all we're the same. I want you to care or else I can't breathe.
I Can't Breathe by Nicole Millick. Welcome back to Local Talk. We are your hosts, Anne Kinzel and Ursula Rudenberg.
And this morning we welcome back Susan Guiazza, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. So what's shaking in the city, Susan?
A couple of things I just wanted to start out with. As you're probably aware, in the spring we delayed our no-charge yard waste free day. And so we've had a lot of phone calls about that in the last couple of weeks, but it has now been rescheduled. So mark your calendars. Saturday, June 27th, we'll have No Charge Yard Waste Day at Green RU, which used to be known as Chamness Technology, at 400 Friel Drive, which is the location it's been at for the last couple of years. That is Saturday, June 27th, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. There will be appropriate social distancing, so that is a very popular event, and sometimes you can wait in line to do your yard waste drop. It will be longer this time. So bring your patients with you if you attend this event. And also we are offering an alternative day. If you come to Resource Recovery and pick up a voucher, you can go on the Friday before, which is June 26th. It's a one-time use voucher. You take your voucher with you when you go to the yard waste site and drop it with your leaves. So I know a lot of people are looking forward to that. There's more information on our website, cityofames.org. But I wanted to get that out there because I know that people are doing a lot of yard work. The other thing that they're doing a lot of and beginning to get back to is remodels, construction, home improvements, and I thought it would be a good idea to bring our building official, Sarah Van Meetren, with me as a guest today just to talk about how her area of expertise has continued to work through the pandemic and how they're starting to see sort of a return to business at this point.
Well, this is exciting. I'm glad to hear that there's Yard Waste Day. Perhaps my little miscreant neighbor who has now been burning leaves for weeks will be inspired to go to Yard Waste Day. He's clearly missed it. Well, Sarah, good morning. You're a building official for the City of Ames. What is your area of responsibility? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The inspection division is a division of the fire department. It's kind of unique across the country. There's not many inspection divisions that actually fall under the fire department, but we really think it's the most appropriate place for us. We focus a lot on making sure that buildings that are built safe, structurally sound, fire resistant, and that really helps give our fire department an edge up when they enter a structure. It gives them more time. It gives our citizens more time to get out. So we really like the relationship that we have with the fire department and where we sit as opposed to being in kind of a business development department.
Let's say I want to redo my kitchen and I have to pull a permit. Are you the folks I do that with?
We would be, yeah. So you can go online. We actually have a new permitting portal. So you can go onto our website and pull the permit right online. We'll review it. We'll issue it. You can make payment for the permit. You can request inspections online. It's pretty cool. We've had it in a place for, I think, maybe a year now, and it's worked really well for those that are a little more tech savvy and want to just kind of have a one-stop shop to get things done. So, yes, please pull your permit, and please don't burn your leaves.
Well, I would not have thought of the fire department as the place where I'd go get my building permit. That is kind of different.
Our division has the building and trades component to it as well as the rental housing component. So we do all rental housing inspections. We have over 15,000 rental housing units that we inspect on a regular basis. And then we have the building and trades side. So on a normal year, we have about 4,000 permits and do 7,000 to 8,000 inspections on those. We also have our code enforcement side who enforces a lot of the zoning code and kind of the miscellaneous sections from the municipal code regarding grass height, outdoor storage, junk vehicles, those types of nuisance issues in your neighborhood. So we really do quite a variety of things.
Well, as we've learned throughout the show, it seems like no area of life has been unturned by the pandemic. How has this affected your work in inspections and permitting and so on?
Yeah, it greatly affected what we do. You know, we're in and out of people's homes, and that's something people aren't comfortable with right now. So for a few months, we stopped all rental inspections. Our rental inspectors found other projects to do, cleanup stuff within the rental code. So that's been helpful, but they were really itching to get back into their normal work routine. So we did start doing inspections again June 1st, and we're going into single family residences for now, and structures with 6 dwellings or less. We didn't really feel it was appropriate yet to go into the large multifamily complexes and in and out and in and out of what could be, you know, 50 units a day. We just didn't. It's not worth it for us right now. So they're wearing their proper PPE and practicing social distancing. We're hoping the managers can help us unlock all the doors ahead of time, turn light switches on, and reduce the number of contacts we have to touch.
A fair amount of renters in our community are students. How does this affect the inspection work? Presumably quite a few of them are not here.
Yep. So the our inspections don't require the tenant to be present. We just require that the property manager has given them a 24-hour notice of the inspection. So some want to be present. Some don't want anything to do with it. Some don't really care. They just don't want us there. But ultimately, we do have to get in and you know, we're checking the basics. Smoke detectors are working. Fire extinguishers are in place. Just that the structure is still safe. And tenants can do a lot of wear and tear on buildings, so over the years, it's important for us to get in and make sure that it still has an equivalent amount of safety as to when it was built.
What about builders? What kind of activities are you seeing in the last several months? Have things slowed down? Are they picking up? What's the activity profile look like?
We've actually seen not a major change in the building permits. It seems like contractors are continuing to do work. I think it's a little different than rental housing because those, you know, you get to choose if you want a contractor to come into your home and do a project. And if that fits your comfort level, you can have someone do that. And you just have to expect that an inspection will come with that at some point. On the rental side, you don't really have a choice. Your letter of compliance is due and we're going to come in and take a look, whether you really want us there or not. So the building side has really, we haven't seen a decrease in the amount of residential building permits. So we're seeing a lot of people that are probably stuck at home right now thinking, well, now's a really great time to remodel my basement. So really the permit numbers for that didn't go down. The inspections for that did because during this time we have not been conducting inspections of occupied spaces. We gave the contractors an opportunity they could take pictures or FaceTime and do an inspection that way. If our inspector was able to see what they needed to do, we could approve the inspection through that. If not, if the inspector wasn't comfortable and couldn't see anything or everything that they needed to, we just postponed it until now. So we are going into occupied spaces now.
So if someone was redoing, say, an electrical panel in a residential property, you're not inspecting those on site?
We were beginning June 1st, we began doing that again. We were allowing them to take pictures. And so I think our inspectors have built a really great relationship with our customers, and the customers know what to expect. They know what we're looking for when we do the inspection. So they are really, really helpful in getting us the pictures that we need. And, you know, at the end of the day, if we're not comfortable, if there's something we can't see, especially as important as an electrical panel, we're not going to approve it. So we really want to get back and take a look at it.
Do you think this is going to change the way your department does business moving forward?
So we've talked about that, and we anticipate having customers call in and want to do a photo inspection. You know, a lot of people don't want us in their homes, so they probably will continue to ask for that. But we really, the comfort level of our inspectors isn't at 100% when we're doing photo inspections. So for the time being, we're going to continue to say we need to get in there. We're not going to accept photos. It's just part of our process, and we're more comfortable being hands-on and eyes-on.
For any of these properties that were inspected by photos, do you anticipate going back and doing some, say, quality checks or anything like that?
Not at this time. So we've documented, if it was a FaceTime inspection or something we could record, or the photos, we've attached them to that permit file in our records and made really good notes that the inspection was conducted via photos so that, you know, if we have to go back and take a look at something, we can. A lot of inspections done over this time were water heater and furnaces. You know, we can't really help when those go out. So, and a lot of them happen to be on rental properties, which thankfully we'll get back into and take a look at. So we will have eyes on some of those. That's helpful, but probably not popping back into all of them.
Well, as we've seen this morning and throughout our pandemic shows, the amount of creativity brought in by both individuals and institutions has been really inspiring. Can you tell me what is one thing that completely amazed you in your work and your response to the pandemic?
Honestly, the amazement I've had has been with our team and their flexibility in this change. You know, we're very regimented in what we do, and our team members are very used to a routine schedule. And I've been so impressed and grateful for their ability to be flexible and willing to work with customers through this, explain what we're requiring. And then on the same end, our customers accepting that this is kind of our new way of doing business right now, and it's just how it's going to be. So I really, really appreciate the flexibility everybody's given. That's helped the process go a lot smoother.
Well, times like these really, as they say, show us who we are, right?
And that's right.
Thank you so much, Sarah Van Meteren.
Van Meteren.
Say it again.
Van Meteren.
Van Meteren. Thank you. Building official for the City of Ames. We appreciate you coming and sharing some of that world with us. And thank you, Susan Guiasta, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames, for coming by with your updates and your help with the show in general. Thank you so much.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
The light and all those hearts so heavy. Oh, I don't wanna pray no more, 'cause I don't even know what for, if all the steps are weary. We all got pretty used to this, closing our eyes in disbelief, but that won't make it any better. We sit in silence day by day, hoping it will just go away, pass until it doesn't matter. But I want us to change, I want us to say their names, think of it as a mistake or else I can't breathe. I want us to feel their pain, 'cause after all we're the same. I want us to care, or else I can't breathe. On every day we feel tongue tied. Another body's getting tired of all the weight it carries. And I was raised to give my all, stand up tall in case you fall, but this is getting scary. 'cause we all got pretty used to this, closing our eyes in disbelief, but that won't make it any better. We sit in silence day by day, hoping it will just go away, pass until it doesn't matter. But I want us to change, I want us to say their names, think of it as a mistake or else I can't breathe. I want you to feel their pain, 'cause after all we're the same. I want you to care or else I can't breathe.
I Can't Breathe by Sangha. Anna Banana, have you joined us?
Yes, it's Anna Banana with heart-to-heart messages that I think embraces the spirit of today's local talk, which, as Ann Kinzel puts it, human creativity keeps on going. Much like Jeremy Thoroughby, today's guest, that model shop manager with the College of Design, who designed that plastic ear saver to be worn with PPE, and your other guests today. About a month ago, our own KHOI's Pat Schaumbaum introduced me to his sister, Kathy Stavnik, who is a registered interior designer in Des Moines. As Pat talked about the heart-to-heart segment, she had just listened to a continuing education program hosted by the International Interior Design Association with a global reach. And so Kathy and I had a conversation that happened within this webinar where they were sharing information about how these firms are providing healthcare solutions to their projects, helping with the pandemic. For example, there's an interior design firm that's helping with using their 3D printers for important medical equipment. I did go to their blog, and I found the forward thinking that was happening within this interior design association was really inspiring and helpful. So the 2020-21 International Board President, Sasha Wagner, discussed the role of community and design and the process of evolving through crisis. So I'll just read his response to a question about what is the future of the workplace. We are currently operating in triage mode, retrofitting existing workplaces and adjusting how we use them for the next year or more. How much of this initial response will influence long-term post-pandemic decisions on real estate footprints and workplace design remains a critical question. Designers and clients are being forced to rethink the very nature of interactions between people in the built environment. Making people feel safe as well as be safe will be the key. Organizations will likely become more resilient and agile and think of their workforce more supportively, I hope. The purpose and function of the office will evolve, and designers will continue to work with our forward-thinking clients, design places for culture and connection. And the next person in the blog, whose name is Angie Lee, who is a partner and design director of interiors in New York, was asked, how do you see the role of women in today's crisis? And Angie Lee answered this, women have a unique set of strengths that we've cultivated long before this current crisis. As we identify the countries best managing the pandemic, I am paying close attention to the women leading those governments and can say with even more confidence that we should lean into our innate tendencies to find compassionate and intuitive resolutions. Women are long overdue to step away from those traditional leadership templates that are offered to us but rarely fit our instincts. Instead of faking it till we make it, we should lean into the fact that we are more likely to be prepared and qualified for the positions we're currently in and those we'll eventually fill. Our role now, more than ever, is to step into the light and stop casting our assets as drawbacks, continue banding together to amplify our voices and design for a wider and inclusive expanse of humanity. And then the last one is from Lindsay Millswick, who is a senior associate in Chicago. And she was asked, what or who inspires you? And I love this. Her answer was, people inspire me. They always have, but is particularly magnified during this pandemic. I'm someone who prefers small groups and one-on-one interactions. I get excited learning about someone's background or hearing stories about their life. I think not only does this have to do with work, interior design, space, I hope that we can get excited about hearing each other's stories and engage in meaningful conversations, that we are inspired by what is possible when we take the opportunity to rethink and expand our viewpoints. So thank you for listening to these individual heart-to-heart messages that connect us to a community of love, care, and support that is KHOI, the heart of Iowa, which is you and me, where we listen to and rethink and expand our own viewpoints with our questions, our interviews, and our stories.
You've been listening to Local Talk. We've been your hosts, Ann Kinzel and Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in with us. Local Talk was engineered by Mike Murphy and co-produced by Lynn Carey with the help of Susan Guiazda. You can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to guests and information you heard during the show. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org.
Theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris. You also heard I Can't Breathe, two music homages to George Floyd by Nicole Millick and Sangha. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI, and we'll see you again on the radio.